This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Linda Mottram here with PM tonight. The Prime Minister decries a law and order problem after Sunday's riot in suburban Melbourne, and Victoria's police union agrees.
Victoria has a public order problem at the moment, and, you know, I think only a fool would say that we don't. I couldn't, in all honesty, stand up here and say that in light of this incident, in light of Taylor's Hill, in light of St Kilda, that we don't have a problem. And I think that anybody that does that's kidding themselves.
And Melbourne and Sydney lead the latest property price falls. Owners see wealth evaporate while some buyers look for a deal.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity, but really, is it a good idea to jump into some of those markets? You do have to consider that. In other markets, such as in the inner areas, if you're buying a quality property, they tend not to fall in value.
Those stories ahead on PM. First, though, Myanmar's government is facing new international criticism after a court in Yangon sentenced two Reuters journalists to 7 years in prison with hard labour for exposing a massacre of 10 Rohingya men late last year. Wa Lone and Kyo So U were reporting on the Rohingya crisis when they were arrested in December 2017 after they had gathered evidence of the murders at the village of In Din, complete with photos and later satellite evidence that we'll talk about shortly. The two journalists denied the claims against them. They've always maintained they were just doing their jobs. Here's Wa Lone speaking in February.
We didn't do anything wrong. You know, we are in the prison, just like waste of my time. I should be in the newsroom. I am a journalist. I never do anything wrong. So I try to be strong.
Wa Lone. But today the court found him and Kyo So U guilty of breaching a colonial era law, which is about state secrets. And that's all quickly drawn condemnation and calls for the journalists' freedom from the UN, the European Union and several individual European nations. The reporting done by Wa Lone and Kyo So U was key to a special report published by Reuters called Massacre in Myanmar, which included a chilling image of the 10 men just before death, kneeling and grim-faced in a field with armed men behind them. Reuters Asia editor is Kevin Krolicki. He's in Myanmar's capital, Yangon, today and was outside the court when the verdict was handed down. He joined me a little earlier.
Well, this is it's a deeply disappointing result. It's disappointing for us at Reuters. It's heartbreaking for the families and the colleagues of Wa Lone and Kyo So U who've already been imprisoned for 8 months. And what happened today is a threat to the rule of law and the free press that democracy requires and democracy in Myanmar requires.
Your colleagues were found guilty of breaching a law on state secrets by obtaining confidential documents. They testified that they were given the documents by police moments before other police arrested them. How do you describe what happened in that circumstance?
They testified, and the record shows that they were asked to meet a police contact in December of last year. They were given documents that they had never seen, and shortly after leaving that meeting, before they'd even seen those documents, they were arrested. You know, further, a prosecution witness, a police officer in the trial, testified that he was in the district police headquarters where the police talked about a plan to entrap Wa Lone and Kyo So U. Journalism is not a crime. Myanmar's own constitution safeguards a free press. In this case, there was a real crime. There was a mass killing, a killing of 10 men and boys in Rakhine State. And that's what Wa Lone and Kyo So U were reporting at the time of their arrest. That's what the police were trying to block. And unfortunately, today's verdict provides support to that effort. And it's an injustice.
So you agree that this was effectively a setup of your journalists?
Yeah, there's no question. They were arrested for the reporting that they were conducting and in an attempt, a failed attempt to block the publication of that reporting.
A failed attempt, as you say, Reuters has gone on to document the reporting that Wa Lone and Kyo So U did and additional content as well. How central was their work in particular on the ground in uncovering this case of assassination?
Well, we wouldn't know. The world wouldn't know about what happened in In Din just over a year ago and how 10 men and boys were killed there at a time when ultimately 700,000 Rohingya Muslims would be fleeing Myanmar. Their reporting was central. They have the lead bylines on that story. We published that story because they wanted it published. They continue to believe that telling the truth, establishing facts, reporting fairly and impartially is their contribution and our best contribution.
What will be the impact, in your view, of today's court decision on other journalists and others who want to report on the activities of Myanmar's government?
Well, there's no question this is a step backwards. This will have a chilling effect. The court today conflated legitimate journalism in the public interest with espionage under a law that dates back to 1923. So it's an injustice that can't stand, but the government of Myanmar has an opportunity and a responsibility now to do the right thing, to intervene here and to set Wa Lone and Cho Seo free.
The men's lawyers today said that they would appeal against the decision. Do you expect that there's any chance of a reversal here?
Well, we've respected the judicial process as it's played out. I, you know, could not more vehemently disagree with the verdict, as I've made clear. We're going to look at every avenue that's open to us now, including international forums, to seek their release.
In terms of international reaction, what is the role for governments and diplomacy in the face of this decision today?
I couldn't really advise them, but you've seen in the few hours since the verdict a very strong, very firm reaction from a number of governments. Many of them are represented in court and have had observers in court throughout this process because they see it as a watershed moment. They see it as a test for the rule of law. They see it as a test for democracy and Myanmar's progress to democracy.
And just finally, has this whole episode affected or changed the way in which Reuters reporters work in Myanmar?
Well, we're committed to telling the story here. As I've said, I think we believe that's our role. And Wa Lone and Cho Seo have been strong and unwavering through this, and we've drawn strength from their strength. Wa Lone, upon leaving court today, was saying, I'm not afraid. I know what we did. I believe in justice. I believe in the freedom of the press, and I believe in democracy. We believe, you know, reporting here from here impartially and fairly is our contribution, and it's a way to honour them too.
Kevin Krolicki, thank you very much for joining us on PM.
Thank you.
Reuters Asia editor Kevin Krolicki. Despite the convictions and jailing of Wa Lone and Cho Seo, there is no doubt that the massacre they uncovered of 10 Rohingya men at Indin village on the 2nd of September 2017 did take place. As well as field evidence, Reuters used satellite imagery to assemble and verify the events surrounding the murders. Satellite imagery has been used widely to help verify testimony that Myanmar's government has engaged in what the UN calls a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. So just how important is it, and other high-tech options like drones, big data and social media analysis, to proving such cases around the world? Well, Joshua Lyons does just that sort of high-tech data collection and analysis for the global rights group Human Rights Watch. He's currently in Australia on a speaking tour and joined me in the studio prior to the decisions in the cases of Wa Lone and Cho Seo.
The most recent application of the satellite imagery in the context of the crimes against humanity committed in Rakhine State was the documentation of a new government strategy of bulldozing and demolishing previously burned Rohingya villages. The official position for this policy was to prepare for the resettlement of the Rohingya people who had fled into Bangladesh across the border. But a more critical interpretation of that demolition is that it is also accomplishing the act of destruction of physical and forensic evidence that exists in these villages to this day. No one physically had access to those locations. Now, we hear about it. We see reports from the government, but we have no independent ability to verify that on the ground. And that's exactly why the satellite imagery has a critical role in providing an independent monitoring mechanism for human rights investigators, for the United Nations, for example.
There's another example I'm interested to hear your explanation of, I suppose, which is a case in Mosul in Iraq after it was retaken from the Islamic State group and Iraqi security forces were in the city alleged to be committing abuses. Can you describe for me what you did in that case?
In that particular case, we had access to a particular video that had been uploaded to social media showing Iraqi government forces arbitrarily executing and dumping bodies into a river. And the critical challenge, obviously, was to try and verify it, to establish the authenticity and the date and the time. In many of these cases, there is a fundamental verification challenge because we know in point of fact that multiple actors are deliberately and maliciously leaking fake videos. On top of that, many people who are trying their best to document it on the ground mistakenly give wrong material. So there's a huge burden to establish the locations and veracity. And so in this particular case, we had this video. It was very, very striking. And the challenge in this case was to try and identify landmarks and very unique features that we could establish and identify from the video frames and match those to precise locations within Mosul. In without knowing anything more, this process could have taken many days or weeks or very likely resulted in no determination. The key part of this was having a researcher in Human Rights Watch on the ground who was able then to quickly show the video to other people who were familiar with that, with Mosul and in the alleged location. And very quickly, within a matter of minutes, we had very precise recommendations of where to look. And it was that interaction between the people on the ground and myself remotely that allowed us to then identify the exact physical locations. And that proved to be a critical step toward establishing the veracity of the film, of which then was publicized and led, I believe, to significant investigations about those summary executions.
What about the effectiveness? Do you see governments, authorities responding positively, if you like, to your advocacy now that you're using these sorts of techniques?
Very early on, when we started to combine the traditional testimony with satellite imagery, for example, seemingly more independent and scientific, that put them off guard. And in many cases, the government's response was to basically accept it. Now, that didn't necessarily translate into meaningful action on their part, but they did not tend to dismiss it outright because it seemed patently absurd to do so. Now, I think, unfortunately, that period has gone, and now what we see in point of fact is that many governments feel quite adept at releasing their own satellite imagery or drone imagery or imagery acquired from military helicopters and then misrepresenting what that imagery actually shows. And then it becomes essentially a debate between a government and a non-governmental organization about the interpretation of imagery. But it does not intrinsically change the reality that the evidence that we have collected and interpreted is still evidence that will have a meaningful legal value in a criminal proceeding should it reach that stage.
Joshua Lyons, very good of you to join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Joshua Lyons is a satellite imagery analyst for Human Rights Watch, and there is a longer version of that interview at our website. Search ABC PM or go to the ABC Listen app. Some domestic news now, and Victoria Police has angrily denied that it was ill-equipped to tackle a riot in inner suburban Melbourne early on Sunday morning. The Prime Minister, though, says the incident is more evidence Victoria has a law and order problem, and the police union agrees. In Sunday morning's incident, about 200 young people, described as being mostly of African or Pacific Islander background, rampaged through the streets. One, who was hit by a car, has since had his leg amputated. Samantha Donovan prepared this report.
This is the noise residents of a Collingwood street woke to early Sunday morning. Video of the riot obtained by Melbourne's Herald Sun newspaper shows a huge group of youths fighting in the street that left a record label launch at a nearby pub. Like Malcolm Turnbull and Peter Dutton before him, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is declaring the Victorian Labor government is soft on crime. He spoke to Radio 3AW.
And I feel for Victorians who are asking the big question, why is this happening in our city? There's a law and order problem, clearly, in Victoria.
The police union, the Victorian Police Association, agrees there is a problem. The association's secretary is Wayne Gash.
I think Victoria has a public order problem at the moment, and, you know, I think only a fool would say that we don't. Anybody that does that's kidding themselves. We want our members to be properly supported and properly resourced so that they can go out there and support the community.
But Victoria Police denies it hadn't planned properly for the record label launch. Acting Deputy Commissioner Bob Hill has confirmed the police had asked the venue not to hold the event because it was concerned about the risk of violence.
Victoria Police was aware that we were having people participating or attending the event that were known to us, that were known to have a criminal history that presented a risk should that event proceed. Now, the Gasometer Hotel sought advice and legal advice from the Fitzroy Legal Service, and they were involved in meetings with Victoria Police, and they made a decision based on our advice that it should proceed. Now, once that decision was made for that event to proceed, Victoria Police then undertook with the event organiser, the licensee and Fitzroy Legal Service, undertook a process where we could mitigate risk. And that involved making assessment of the security arrangements. That involved having community elders and leaders be present on the night. That also involved a significant police presence on the evening.
Deputy Commissioner Hill denies the police took a business-as-usual approach on Saturday night.
We had our core deployment with additional staff deployed. We had large numbers rostered and focused on and tasked to this particular venue. We had police attend this venue during the course of the evening. We had police patrol the area, we had local police, we had our public order response teams, we had police visit inside the premises. Our presence was well known and seen by those that were inside the venue. To suggest that Victoria Police was not prepared for this event, to suggest that our rostering wasn't adequate, to suggest that we've got a no arrest policy is absolute nonsense. Don't get me wrong though, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation if I could, and we did have multiple arrests on the weekend. The fact remains we didn't. What's, you know, the preferred option for me or the preferred outcome? Yeah, we arrest people.
Only one person has been arrested over the incident but has since been released. The Police Association's Wayne Gatt agrees the lack of arrests will embolden some of the offenders.
People are allowed to get away with actions as a result of, wild brawls, and they realise that that time and time again they can get away without any consequence. Well, of course they're going to come back thinking that third, fourth and fifth time. And our members that responded to this basically told us that their first priority was the ill and injured on the streets, followed by protecting themselves. They simply didn't have enough numbers, as they initially responded, to make any arrests. What goes wrong here isn't what happens on the night, it's what happens weeks in advance.
Wayne Gatt from the Victorian Police Association. Samantha Donovan, our reporter. This is PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, a warning that failing to follow up when mental health patients get out of hospital is costing lives.
When you actually get let out into the back into the real world, you're faced with people in your hometown, you know, the feeling of being in a nut house, you know, what do they think of me? And as far as support goes, that's where the help stopped.
Property first, though, and wherever you sit in the property market, owner, wannabe owner or renter, you will probably have noted the current downward trend in house prices and the increase in interest rates by some banks. And while the Reserve Bank tomorrow is not expected to raise rates yet, the current circumstances suggest the housing market will continue to fall. Data out today shows capital city prices have tumbled close to 3% over the past 12 months. So what does it mean for the value in your house if you own one? And should bargain hunters move now? Nick Grimm reports.
Spring might have sprung at the weekend, but the season that traditionally has home bidders warming to their task hasn't generated much heat as yet. Agents can fluff the cushions and arrange fresh flower blooms as much as they like, but the sector's winter of discontent is still cooling the enthusiasm of buyers, with credit tightening and interest rates starting to creep up. As CoreLogic's Tim Lawless told the ABC, 11 months of price falls are showing no sign of ending soon.
I'd say so. I can't see any reasons why we'd start to see values suddenly start to rise again. I think we've got a lot of factors, particularly the tight credit environment. Add to that housing supply that's been quite a substantial increase, fewer foreign buyers, and now we're seeing the first signs of first home buyers maybe just slowing down a little bit in New South Wales and Victoria as well.
And if that's not enough to keep overstretched mortgagees lying awake at night, there are predictions too that things are only going to get worse. Paul Dales is the chief economist for Australia and New Zealand at Capital Economics.
Well, I'm fairly confident they'll continue to fall over the next 6 to 12 months, but I wouldn't actually be surprised if they were to decline gradually over the next 4 years. So we might be talking about falling house prices for some time yet, I'm afraid.
In fact, this forecaster believes the average family home could lose more than 10% of its value before the market picks up again.
I think it's quite useful to put the downturn in context. So prices have fallen by just 3% so far. That's actually the smallest decline in house prices Australia has experienced in the last 40 years. So it's not a big crash yet. But I do think that with credit conditions tightening and mortgage rates rising, eventually this downturn will prove to be the longest and deepest in Australia's history.
But from others with their finger on the pulse of the market, the message is a simple one. Don't panic. Veronica Morgan from Good Deeds Property Buyers is a buyer's agent based in Sydney's inner west. She cautions vendors against a fire sale mentality, while buyers should stay wary about snapping up what might seem like a bargain.
Lots of experts say that Darwin hasn't stopped falling, you know. Some experts say Perth has finished its drops. It's now plateaued, but how long before you start to see some growth? There are various commentators are suggesting if you're buying an apartment in Brisbane, then it's 10 years before you see any growth. So there are certain markets where, yeah, it's a good opportunity, but really, is it a good idea to jump into some of those markets? You do have to consider that. In other markets, such as say, Sydney, which is my bread and butter, in the inner areas, if you're buying a quality property, they tend not to fall in value. It really comes down to the difference between quality and not quality, or the area in which you're looking.
So who does this benefit right now from your perspective as a buyer's agent?
Yeah, look, people are really worried that, you know, prices are falling, but what they fail to realise is that people lose money in property every single day in Australia. And CoreLogic actually put out a report every quarter, which is called the Pain and Gain Report. And pretty much, plus or minus a little bit, 10% of property that transacts every quarter loses money. And that's just off the sale price. That's not including the costs of buying and selling. So I think people have to remember that it's the quality of the asset they're buying that's really important, regardless of the market conditions. They've got to really understand that. And it's a real principle that a lot of us forget about when we're worried about, you know, the bigger market movements.
Buyer's agent Veronica Morgan, Nick Grimm with that report. How confident are you that the food you buy is what it says it is? Concerns about adulterated food making its way into the Australian market flared today after questions were raised about some honey sold in Australian supermarkets. A joint ABC Fairfax report reveals results from a lab which specialises in honey fraud detection, finding nearly half of honey samples selected from supermarket shelves were mixed with something other than nectar from bees. But one major brand is disputing the test's findings. Nancy Notson has more.
Honey is a key ingredient at this cafe in Newcastle in New South Wales.
A lot of the old people come in for teas. A lot of the tradies now have honey in their tea and actually in their coffees as well as an alternative to sugar.
Chef Joe is shocked by revelations a favourite sweetener could be tainted.
I actually think it's disgusting.
But she's been concerned about food quality in general for a while now and only sources her goods from local suppliers.
That is correct. I wouldn't serve something I wouldn't eat myself. I know exactly where it's coming from, who's making it and where I'm getting it from.
Honey is just one example of so-called fake food entering the market. 2 years ago, consumer advocate group Choice found a favourite herb was also regularly contaminated.
Of the 12 products we tested, or that we commissioned a lab to test, we found that 7 contained ingredients other than oregano, olive leaves and sumac leaves. And in some cases, up to 90% of the product wasn't oregano.
Erin Turner is the organisation's Director of Campaigns and Communications.
It's incredibly difficult to detect food fraud and also for independent organisations like Choice to confirm food fraud. The tests are extremely specialised and often very expensive.
And she says there could be more adulterated food making its way onto supermarket shelves.
There is definitely the possibility that there's more food fraud in the Australian market than the tests conducted so far have been able to detect. One of the difficulties here is knowing exactly where the fraud occurred. In some cases, it seemed that either producers or companies didn't even realise that the fraud was occurring.
PricewaterhouseCoopers has estimated food fraud costs the global food industry up to $40 billion US every year. That's just the financial cost.
At its most serious, food fraud can harm people. We've seen issues in the US where foods have been contaminated with peanuts that have been extremely serious for people with allergies, issues in China with baby food harming infants.
For Australian honey producers, there's concern the industry is being brought into disrepute.
This sort of publicity will have negative effects no matter what, because people will just sort of hear honey, unfortunately, and then it will sort of switch off.
Trevor Weatherhead is the executive director of the Australian Honeybee Industry Council. He questions the results of the test used to show some honey samples included substances other than nectar from bees.
Well, we know that two different labs have given two different answers using this NMR testing.
But he says they've been asking the government for years to do more testing of honey coming into the country.
The Australian government does testing. Currently they do 5% on a random basis. We've been asking them for several years now to increase that, and you know, the ideal would be to do 100%.
Until then, he's urging consumers to simply look at their honey label.
You can look at the label, look at the country of origin labelling, you can see that if it's 100% Australian honey, then it'll be 100% Australian honey.
Trevor Weatherhead is the Executive Director of the Australian Honeybee Industry Council. Nancy Notson with that report. Every year, thousands of Australians are admitted to mental health facilities in the hope that they will leave them in better shape. And often they do. But statistics show that in several states, nearly half of those who are discharged are not receiving appropriate follow-up treatment when they return home. In extreme cases, incoherent discharge plans are being blamed for some people taking their own lives. Sawaba Hanifi reports.
Bill Stockman goes out on his boat every week. He says it's helped him manage his depression.
I guess it's like having a spa bath. I guess it just relaxes you.
Bill knows what it's like to leave a mental health facility without follow-up support.
When you actually get let out into the back into the real world, you're faced with people in your hometown, you know, the feeling of being in a nut house, you know, what do they think of me? And as far as support goes, that's where the help stopped.
His experience isn't unique. Through his mental health charity, Ski for Life, Bill Stockman knows of two people who committed suicide shortly after leaving care. And close friend Craig Dixon tried to take his own life after being discharged in 2016.
If you don't have a good discharge plan, it's quite easy to sort of fall back into that state of mind where you're not thinking clearly.
Research by the Black Dog Institute shows coordinated aftercare can decrease suicide attempts by almost 20%. And according to the national targets agreed to by states and territories, outpatients should be connected with community care support within 7 days of their release. But data from the Institute of Health and Welfare indicates more than 30% of mental health patients Australia-wide aren't getting the timely support they need. Some states are falling short in 40% of cases, including South Australia, New South Wales, Western Australia, and the Northern Territory. SANE Australia Deputy Chief Executive Dr. Michelle Blanchard says providing support in the first 3 months is crucial to preventing suicides.
It's really important that people are getting appropriate care and support during that time period. But unfortunately, we know that that's not happening for a vast majority of people. It's not just about, you know, someone receiving clinical care back in the community. It's also about making sure that people are engaged in education, in employment, in housing, that they have strong connections with their family and friends.
The federal government has agreed to provide $37 million for a Beyond Blue discharge program if it wins the next election. Chief Executive Georgie Harmon says it would help equip local support groups in 25 new sites.
What's going to happen is of the 37.6 million, 27 million is for service delivery. And 27 million will go to primary health networks to help them to go out to market and find the right service partners to actually deliver the way back on the ground. So Beyond Blue won't actually provide the service. Our job is to make sure this happens.
The organisations will then work with clients for 3 months after they leave a hospital, addressing their social, psychological and health needs. Ms. Harmon is calling for each of the state and territory governments to support the rollout with their own financial contribution.
Sawaba Hanifi reporting, and Lifeline is always there if you need assistance, 13 11 14. That is PM for this evening. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you to Emma Alberici for filling in while I was on leave for a couple of weeks. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app, so if you missed anything, listen at your leisure. Just search PM and make us a favourite on the app as well so that we're easier for you to find. And you can subscribe to PM wherever you get your podcasts. AM is back in the morning with Sabra Lane and The World Today at lunchtime with Eleanor Hall. I'm Linda Mottram on Twitter. I'm at Linda Mottram. Back tomorrow. More great radio ahead, though, with updates from ABC News throughout the evening. Good night.